We're back with Backstory, the show that puts a little old back into the news. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Ballow, guide to the 20th century and beyond. We're talking today about the idea of the good mother in American history. How has that idea changed over time? And why do we hold up motherhood as such a core American value? A lot of you have already weighed in on our website, backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited some of those weigher-inners to join us on the phone.
Hey, guys. We got a call. It's from Ty from Oakland in California. Ty, welcome to Backstory.
Hi.
Well, we're talking about motherhood. That's a subject of interest to you?
Yes.
So what's your question?
Well, my question is, historically, have African-American and white mothering styles varied so greatly? I think my friends and I have this idea that they've been very different until recently. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious if there's anything historically that we could point to that would actually bear that out.
What a great question.
Yeah. Do you want to start back in slavery days, Ed? I'm just wondering if the conditions of slavery would have led to a different style. And we know the realities of family are different.
Well, you know, when any day that you get up, your children could be sold away from you. It changes things. And also the fact that as soon as you were physically able to get up off the birthing bed and get back to work, that you were expected to do so, and the children were sort of taken care of often by a woman who was too old to work in the fields or the house, and by other children who were too young to mm-hmm. be productive in that way. It suggests a whole kind of strategy of what's called fictive kin. That was so many mothers being sold away from their children, and that the rate of young women having babies dying was remarkably high, that you start having a lot more sense of collective responsibility for children. And there was no other choice because the families were just being ravaged by death and sale and separation. You know, after slavery, one of the first things that black families do is the women want to stay home with their children more. And there's a lot of white complaint about this right after the Civil War. But the sad fact is that for generations after emancipation, work for black women was largely in town in white homes, and work for black men was largely out in the country or in the woods where they're cutting lumber. So the tensions on the family just continued all the way through until really the Great Migration, when industrial jobs gave black families some of the same material underpinnings that white families had enjoyed for over 100 years.
Well, I didn't even really think about it sort of from a slavery perspective. I was sort of thinking about probably the early 20th century and African-American mothers raising children sort of in a world where there was sort of very active, aggressive racism and teaching them to navigate that world.
Yeah, but you know what, Ty? I think Ed has really given us a good language to continue into the 20th century because he talked about strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And although the obstacles were not as draconian as slavery, they were almost as draconian. The first thing that comes to mind about African-American mothering is that most African-American mothers are also workers at a time mm-hmm. when increasingly white mothers are being removed from the workforce. So you're back to strategies. How do you be a good mother when you're also working 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day? And these African-American women were disproportionately employed in the field of domestic service.
Right.
And what are they doing? They're raising other people's kids.
If you think about the words that white people used as they imagined with affection to refer to black women, it was mm-hmm. mammy. And so it was the projection of motherhood for white children onto black women. And in that image, there's not really a place for the black child. So you have this sort of celebration of the natural mothering capacity of black women, but everything is stacked against them for the nurturing of their own children.
Right.
Well, Ty, it's a wonderful set of questions that you raise for us. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, Ty.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you just tuned in, this is Backstory. We're the American History Guys, and we're talking today about a subject near and dear to each of us. That's the history of motherhood.
Hey, guys. We have a call from a very special place, Kingsport, Tennessee, birthplace of Ed Ayers.
Awesome.
Billy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's your question, Billy?
My question is, what do you three men know about motherhood?
At what point can I acknowledge that this is my mom? Hey, Mom.
Hey.
It was so stupid. I didn't realize Billy from Kingsport was going to be Mom until I actually heard her.
I knew we'd have to go to family members for calls eventually. Since we have this rare opportunity, and, you know, we are three guys. None of us are moms, as far as I know. I want to ask you, how did you learn to be the good mom that apparently you were? Intuition, was it your mom? Did you read Dr. Spock? Did you read magazines? I mean, how do you get to be a good mom?
Trial and error.
Trial and error. Let's see, which category did Ed fall into?
No, he's a trial.
Well, I will say this. I am the oldest. So if errors were to be made, I was the first target around.
So what are some of the errors you made?
Oh, you've caught me off guard. I guess not spending more time with them.
Oh.
Very time consuming, teaching and trying to be a mother. Mm-hmm. I taught for 30 years. My other interests, I guess, probably interfered with the time I should have spent being a mother.
That's nonsense.
But he turned out all right, so I must have done something right.
But Mrs. Ayers, was that really an error? I mean, be honest.
No, I honestly don't feel that it was.
I don't know much about you, but I know that Ed talks about what a terrific teacher you were, and
but
how
he wasn't
students
in my class, so he really doesn't know.
No, he's in a class by himself.
Do you think that's really an error? I mean, this is a serious question. Don't you think, I mean, my mom was a working mom, and don't you think there's something that makes moms better if they work?
Sure.
That makes their kids perhaps respect them, or at least exposes them to different models of momhood?
Well, I actually do, because you feel a sense of guilt that when you're away from them that much, you feel that you need to double up on the time you do spend
with
them.
That's very interesting.
Well, and I think it's important, too, Mrs. Ayers, that children learn a basic lesson, and that is they're not exactly the center of the universe.
Wait, I missed that day.
Mrs. Ayers, I have another question for you. I've always wondered about this. Do you like Mother's Day itself? I mean, being mom is such a 24/7 kind of job, and then all of a sudden there's this day where, you know, all this attention is drawn.
And I love it.
And you love it. Right. Mrs. Ayers, we love that kind of definitive answer.
All right, Billy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Happy Mother's Day, Mom.
Well, thank you. It's good talking with you.
Bye-bye.
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 Send her a bunch of roses. Mom loves roses. Make it an extra large bouquet. Send her a bunch of roses, red, red roses. Remember Mother's Day.
Well, guys, speaking of Mother's Day, we've managed to get almost all the way through our show about motherhood without really talking about Mother's Day, which, of course, would be a major omission, especially considering that we're coming up on a big anniversary of the holiday. 99 years ago, this May, the state of West Virginia declared the first official Mother's Day.
Why West Virginia? Well, because that was the home state of Anna Jarvis, the mother, if you will, of Mother's Day. Her story is both little known and tragic, meaning that it's right up the alley of our friend and fellow history podcaster, Nate DeMayo. We asked Nate to find out a little more about Jarvis. Here's what he found out.
Anna Jarvis loved her mother. And because she loved her mother so much, mothers around the world get flowers and cards and candy and hugs from their kids every May, which must have Anna Jarvis spinning in her grave. She was born in 1864 in West Virginia to a woman whose name was also Anna Jarvis. And her mother, Anna Maria, to her daughters Anna Marie, was a remarkable woman. The elder Anna was a feminist and a progressive and a bit of a socialist before any of those words meant anything. In Virginia, in the middle of the 19th century, back before the phrase West Virginia meant anything, she traveled throughout Appalachia, organizing women's groups, teaching them about basic health, and how to demand workers' rights, after teaching them what those rights were in the first place. During the Civil War, she brought women together to tend to sick and wounded soldiers, regardless of whether they wore blue or gray. After the war, with her baby Anna in tow, she held meetings of mothers on both sides. In these proto-group therapy sessions, finding closure through shared grieving kind of things. And she promoted something called Mother's Work Day. This wasn't mother apostrophe S, so not your mother, but mothers, S apostrophe, mothers plural, a collective of mothers. It was a radical idea. Let's take a day, and it would be a day of demonstrations and political consciousness raising, not of flowers or spa gift certificates. Let's take a day and recognize that what mothers do is work. And let's organize those workers the same way that people were starting to do at mines and mills and factories. This was the work of her life. And when she died in 1905, her life became the work of her daughter's life. Anna Marie, the younger Jarvis, was 29 years old and single, with no child of her own. She was devastated by her mother's death. And at her funeral, she handed out hundreds of carnations, one to each of the mothers in the congregation. She had picked up the torch of her own mother's cause and wouldn't put it down for the rest of her life. She delivered speeches. She published pamphlets. She wrote to governors and newspaper editors, senators, mayors, anyone in power, all in a campaign to get the government to recognize Mother's Day. And she succeeded and failed at the same time. People love the idea of a Mother's Day because people love their mothers. And importantly, people love the story of Anna Jarvis loving her own mother. It was a national holiday by 1914, and Jarvis kept going, talking about her mother and Mother's Day all over the world. And for people all over the world, maybe wondering why they'd grown apart from their own mothers, maybe wishing their own children would thank them once in a while. For people all over the world, Anna Jarvis became the platonic ideal of the devoted daughter, and they wrote to her. So many wrote to her to thank her, to unload about their mother-child relationships, that she had to buy a second house next door in which to store her correspondence. Mother's Day would roll around every year, and Anna Jarvis, a woman with no child of her own, would get flowers by the score, heart-shaped boxes of candy by the carload, which made Anna Jarvis furious. The holiday, designed to continue her mother's lifetime of effort working towards social justice and collective action, had gone commercial. Anna had thanked her mother by devoting her life to building a kind of living memorial. And it felt like all she'd accomplished was making it easy for people to go and thank theirs with a prepackaged sentiment and a penny greeting card. And so she railed against it for the rest of her life, spending all of her modest savings on campaigns against the commercialization of Mother's Day, filing lawsuits to stop celebrations, condemning confectioners, fighting florists. But the candy kept coming. And the flowers didn't stop. And when she died, penniless and blind, in a state sanatorium in Pennsylvania in 1948, her room was filled with Mother's Day cards.
That's Nate DeMeo, a reporter out in Los Angeles. You can listen to more of his strange and wonderful accounts of American history at thememorypalace.us. We'll link to it from our own site, backstoryradio.org.
Wow. I think we can just end our show and present that as American history in a nutshell. Workers, collective effort, commercialization versus the individual, and the notion that mother's work drops out, mothers collectively, and, you know, the daughter's devotion to mother, the individual, you know, reigns supreme. That too is another theme in American history.
I think the significant thing here is that families have been dispersed, and forms of expressing solidarity within families that are spread across the continent, I think that's generated an opportunity, a need for communication, for effective and effective bonds that can reconnect families. And to say that this is ritualized and commercialized, that doesn't mean that it loses its meaning. That is the meaning, is to make those connections across space and time.
And, you know, it gives you sort of an excuse to say something sentimental that may not present itself in normal, especially at a distance, you know. So, you know, it's what's interesting is the way that the form of the card is like frozen in time, however.
Yeah.
It bears the mark of the Jarvis story
in
that it's very Victorian, late 19th, early 20th century, frilly, you know, lace. And the language itself is very much of sort of pre-World War I kind of formal and so forth. So it's interesting how that has become ossified as the measure of true devotion.
Okay, guys, but you've almost convinced me. But look at what has dropped out entirely, which is another moment in time, which you know well, Ed. It's the Knights of Labor. It's all this ferment about labor. It's people organizing. It's the great possibility of the populace. That's the beginning of this terrific account of the Jarvises. And that's dropped out of the picture entirely. That's not even ossified. That's just gone.
Yeah, I think that's right. I guess I would say that as fruitless crusades go, this was
top of the list.
Yeah, because it's like...
There's always Esperanto, Ed.
Well, there is that. But, you know, you think about what is more individualized than your mother.
And yeah, mothers work. But that doesn't mean that we forget that when we honor our own mother with the apostrophe S.
No, but we continue to not pay for it.
And that's certainly true, Brian. I'm the principle behind your fruitless comment is I share that entirely, but it's interesting. I would just say not only has that been neglected or even suppressed, but it's been completely replaced with instead, what's the main sentiment expressed in Mother's Day cards? I think that it's gratitude for sacrifice.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Right? And thanks for giving up so much for me, Mom.
Right.
Well, what are we going to do? Start paying mothers? And then, what is it, consumer satisfaction? Mom, this relationship worked out well. I got my value for it.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, you raise me, you get a $2.95 card each year. What do you want? It's like a fair trade to me.
Oh, right, boy. I give up. I give up. I'll never convince you guys. But hey, maybe you listeners can. Drop in at our website and tell us what you think about the holiday. Is it the embodiment of individualism and crass commercialism? Or is it the perfect opportunity for expressing profound emotions that don't get expressed the rest of the year? You can find us at backstoryradio.org. Just click Join the Discussion.
And while you're there, sign up for our free podcast and join us on Facebook.
Again, we're at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger, and happy Mother's Day.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson. Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabi Alter wrote our theme.
Special thanks today to Kevin McFadden and Elliot Majersik. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.